The secrets of the mind have been investigated at all times by most people and also in most scientific disciplines. From philosophy and social science to biology, chemistry and physics. What is it that makes us who we are? What makes the human species so special? And how do we learn and develop through our lives? This episode of the Science and Cocktails podcast is a guided tour through the brain. We will be following axons and crossing synapses to see other dendrites when chasing the physical traits of learning and memories. In a content so dense of connections that it takes years to go through just a few millimeters. I am at the concert hall of the Danish Broadcasting Corporation, waiting for the tour guide, the neuroscientist superstar Jeff Lichtman, who will soon enter the stage. And he will take us through the mind, walking through every single connection between the neurons. He will show us what the brain actually looks like and how it stores information. And he will tell us about what makes the human brain so special, that it is now taking evolution into its own hands by changing the DNA of living organisms and preparing to leave to other planets.
Welcome to the Science and Cocktails podcast.
Get on your spaceship.
Interesting. Eerie.
And now the machine is working.
Increase the frequency of lucid dreams in our laboratories.
Over time, the variation within a group becomes variation between groups.
It has to do with particles or objects and how they move.
Am I true? Am I awake?
We think that there is a kind of God against it.
What are the processes behind?
It's a piece of stuff.
We are moving in space-time. All of us go like 1 second per second, flowing up in the fourth dimension.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I am deeply grateful to be here at Cocktails and Music and Cocktails and Science and more cocktails. It's a great idea to mix these things together.
Before this talk, I had the pleasure of meeting Jeff Lichtman behind the stage to have a talk about his scientific research and what are his motivation and aims. But before we dive deeply into the brain, he needs a proper presentation.
I'm a neurobiologist, meaning I'm interested in life and especially how the nervous system plays an important role in living things, animals that have nervous systems. And my focus is on the details, the structural details that allow a nervous system to do the amazing things it does. And this field is sometimes called connectomics, which we used as a joke when we began calling it that. We didn't think that this would catch on. We weren't even trying to make it catch on, but it is a field that studies the connections between nerve cells in the same sort of general vein as genomics studies the structure of genetic material. Connectomics studies the structure of the connectivity between nerve cells.
So in general, how close are we to understand the human brain?
Yeah, I may be somewhat extreme, but I think we're next to nowhere. We've hardly begun. And I think this is a huge problem because humans always kind of wallpaper over the things we don't understand and sort of have a ready explanation for everything from the birth of the universe to consciousness. We have theories for all these things, and so we don't lose sleep over the fact that we don't have explanations. But truth be told, the area I know best, neuroscience, I think there are many fundamental questions where we just do not have a good answer.
With scientific questions about how the neurons communicate, are you most interested in finding the answers to?
My personal interest, which stems from work that began when I was a graduate student, at least for me, is how do nervous systems instantiate information that's learned? Where does your memories reside? And maybe even a more general question, how are memories put into a brain? We have all these remarkable things that we cram our brains with, but what is the physical underpinnings of those things? If I ask you, you know, what does your mother look like, or what's the name of your dog, if you have a dog, it's there, but where and in what form is it? That is a deep and surprisingly hard question to get an answer to. And I'm laying a bet that basically, if you look at the brain, it's filled with gazillion wires connecting nerve cells, so that may be the place to look.
In the brain, there are millions of neurons, which are the brain cells responsible for communication in the brain. The neurons have a body, which is called the soma, and then they have some arms stretching away from the soma. One long arm stretching far away from the soma is called the axon, which is the part sending information from the cell to other neurons or muscles. Smaller arms, looking more like growing branches, are closer to the soma, and they are called the dendrites. And they receive information from other neurons and passes it on to the soma. So how do they communicate? The dendrites of one neuron gets stimulation and send a signal to the soma, which causes an electrical impulse, causing the axon of the neuron to release a neurotransmitter, which are small molecules, into the synapse, which is a small gap between two neurons. On the one side of the gap, there is the axon releasing the neurotransmitter. And on the other side of the gap, there is a dendrite from another neuron, which has special receptors that receive the neurotransmitters. When the receptors receive the neurotransmitters, they send a signal to the soma. And if the signal is strong enough, the soma will generate an electrical impulse, causing the axon to release neurotransmitter that can be received by another neuron. It's kind of like an old-fashioned phone chain. The answer to how knowledge and memories are stored in the mind is believed to lie in how the connections of this big network is wired. Which neurons are connected to which through the axons and dendrites. One neuron has many connections to many different neurons and can have many connections to the same neuron. To be connected basically means that they talk together by sending signals from the one neuron's axons to the other neuron's dendrites. The signal being neurotransmitters released by the axon crossing the synapse received by the dendrites.
You could imagine that a brain that has learned a lot of things is wired differently than a brain that has learned other things. There's lots of implications of that fact. One would be that once your brain has chosen what it has learned based on the experiences it's had, it becomes somewhat impervious or unresponsive to ideas that no longer are in the wiring diagram. And it's why adults, I think, so often can have an impossible argument where both sides are sure they're right and they just cannot convince the other because it's no longer possible because the wiring diagram of the other person no longer contains the necessary pieces. And that may sound fanciful, but I think it is probably true.
When the brain matures and we learn different things, the wiring of the brain changes and it becomes less open or adaptable to other ideas and ways of seeing things. Which is why, as Jeff Lichtman explains, two adults can have an impossible argument.
I'm just lucky that my development left me with the right connections, but everyone else, I don't know.
We'll get back to how physically the wiring diagram of the brain is changing. But first, Jeff Lichtman will tell us about how he came to study this wiring diagram.
I am a product of my own experiences. My graduate work many, many decades ago was focused on the question of how a small group of nerve cells that are responsible for salivation in the rat, a truly uninteresting question, as my mother pointed out to me, why would anyone be interested in this? How profoundly that wiring diagram changed after a rat is born. And the change was not what I had expected. It was that the baby rat's wiring for salivation was much more complicated at birth than it was in the adult. You may know, human children drool a lot. And I think the same idea is true there, that our wiring diagram is open to all possibilities of how to regulate this one very unimportant thing, saliva secretion. And then out of this very all-to-all type of connectivity, a very small subset of connections remain that allow you to have very good control over when to secrete saliva, when to keep some resting moisture in your mouth, but not drool and not have dry mouth. So I did that not because I was interested in saliva, but I was interested in how brains develop. And it was striking to me that a mammal might be born with a nervous system that was wired quite differently than an adult. And I've still been studying that ever since. Basically, this is all just is an extrapolation of work that I did as a graduate student.
But how does the wiring change?
So this is a long story, but to sort of summarize the idea, nerve cells don't think they're part of you. They think of themselves as single-celled organisms in a very complicated milieu, a weird pond, if you will. And they're competing for space where they get some kind of trophic support. And that competition is what leads to some connections getting weaker and others getting stronger. And it turns out that the use of a nerve cell is probably an important part in its ability to outcompete another nerve cell that is not active at the same time. So that there's a kind of reorganization of an ecosystem, a very competitive ecosystem, where every neuron loses some of its early connections and makes a foothold that's very strong on a subset. And so you start out with a very complicated wiring diagram where everybody's talking to everybody. And then by the end, you have a much simpler one where each nerve cell has a bunch of things to do, but it does those quite powerfully.
When a baby is born, it has a huge diversity of connections between neurons. Everyone talks to everyone, but the connections are weak. And as the brain matures, some connections are cut and some are getting stronger. One can say that the mind develops from complexity towards simplicity. This means that the neurons in the brain gets less but stronger connections.
By strong, what I mean is that there are many, many synapses between one cell and another, and so they become relatively indelible. Maybe a synapse would fall off, but the connection is so strong it makes no difference. And this perhaps explains why memories persist, for 20, 30, 50, 80, if you're lucky, 90 years, you can remember things from your early childhood, because those memories are so strongly built into the nervous system that even if by random chance a synapse pulled off, there was such strength in those connections that they're relatively indelible to destruction.
Does that mean then also that if you once you learn something, it could also be like a trauma you're having, then it's really difficult to change, like to unlearn something again?
Yeah, I think the idea of post-traumatic stress disorder is literally this. I think the idea of addiction is literally this. It's that once the nervous system has learned something, even if it's maladaptive, it's very, very hard to unlearn it. That's basically what we saw in the peripheral nervous system, both in this salivary gland regulation system. And then later, I spent 30 years studying it at the neuromuscular junction, which is the spinal cord nerve cells that activate muscle. And the same rules applied, to my surprise. And now we're focusing on the central nervous system. And we're seeing something that's interesting. Very interesting, because humans continue to be able to modify and learn throughout life to some degree. So there has to be a residuum of weak connections that can be made strong. And so we're seeing both super strong connections and very weak connections in adult, even human brains.
The discovery of the immature brain being more complex than the mature brain by having a greater variety of connections is key in all Jeff Lichtman's work and what has been fueling his curiosity and defining his scientific path. And it will be the outstanding highlight that this podcast will circle around. Before we go into the details of how Jeff Lichtman and the rest of his lab at Harvard University is mapping the brain to understand the wiring of the brain and how it is changing when knowledge is stored, we will first take a journey back in history of neuroscience. The Greek physician and philosopher Galen, who lived in year 100 and 200, claimed in the antique that the brain was responsible for processing emotions and memory. And much later, around 1630, René Descartes wrote about body-soul duality, where he believed that the brain was responsible for behavior. His idea put him at the forefront of the mind-brain debate and still shapes neuroscience today.
Neurobiology began with the originator of neurobiology, the first person who really looked at brains. This was Santiago Ramón y Cajal.
Santiago Ramón y Cajal lived from 1852 to 1934. He was a Spanish neuroscientist specialized in neuroautonomy and the central nervous system.
He was certainly the greatest neuroanatomist who ever lived. And here he is sitting at a table with three microscopes. One was not good enough because he had different kinds of objectives on each of them, and a whole raft of chemicals, most of which are highly toxic, in the background. He was way ahead of his time. He took more selfies than any other scientist of his time. This actually is a selfie. And I know that because his selfies always have one hand clutched because he's holding a little squeezer that sets a flash off. He really would have enjoyed being here tonight. Notice here a little glass of sherry, which is really wrong. If you're a scientist, never eat while doing science, especially with chemicals like this. He used the Golgi stain, which is an unusual stain made by an Italian scientist, Camillo Golgi, to study the nervous system to elucidate many fundamental principles of the nervous system's organization.
Cajal used the specific stain called the Golgi stain, which only colored the neurons, and that made it possible to detect the pathway of the information. And he made hundreds of beautiful drawings illustrating brain cells looking like growing trees, which has been used ever since for educational and training purposes.
He was basically an artist. He wanted to be an artist. His father wanted him to be a doctor. And he ended up doing pathology and then realized when he looked in a microscope that he could draw these things he saw in the microscope, and he found a happy place. His drawings are masterpieces. They're just gorgeous. They show details that are remarkable. And he inferred from these static dead pictures some deep insight, which was that the brain cells are connected to each other in a directional network, as opposed to just a vast interconnected syncytium. So the Golgi stain is a very sparse stain, first of all. If it were more successful and stained every cell in the brain, it would have been useless, because everything would have been stained and the brain would just be a big brownish-black mass. But because it was sparse staining, Cajal could see things like this. And notice here these Nobel Prize-winning arrows. Those are the things that got him a Nobel Prize.
The reason why those arrows got Cajal the Nobel Prize is that they show the direction of the information flow.
And he said this information somehow that is in the axon passes over to the dendrites. Now we would call this a synapse. And that interplay of the communication of information from an axon to the dendrite sends information into this cell that then sends that information out its own axon. Notice these arrows.
Cajal made this cartoon-like drawing of a mosquito landing on the skin of a person, causing the neuron to react. The signal is sent along the neural network to the brain sending a signal to the motor cortex, causing the hand and the arm to move, and flicks the mosquito away.
And this was a profoundly interesting idea because it gave insight into how behavior might work. But that wasn't the end of it. It was that neuroscience became, just as anyone could understand basically this idea here, based on very sparse staining. In fact, no one has ever traced a pathway this long. It was so compelling that neuroscientists like me grew up thinking about the brain in this kind of chain of causality. Made a lot of sense.
He died at the age of 82 and continued to work even on his deathbed. Jeff Lichtman, too, has been studying those neurons for decades.
So at your lab, you study activity-dependent plasticity. What does that mean?
Yes, so that's just a fancy neuroscience word for saying that experience changes the wiring diagram, by plasticity being a fancy way of saying things can change. That's all that means.
So how do you study that?
So we have taken several approaches, but they all aim to see what happens and what changes in a nervous system in terms of who is connected to who. And one can do this with electron microscopy by doing electron microscopic volumes of tissue at different ages and then interpolate what must have happened in between. Or one can use techniques where cells are labeled vitally with a dye that you can see in a living animal, and then you can watch the same synapse mature or change over time. And we've done that, and to make that more easy to see different nerve cells at the same time, we developed an approach called Brainbow, where each nerve cell is a different color, so we can watch different nerve cells over time by just looking at the blue cell over and over again and how does it fare compared to the yellow cell, for example.
Yeah, and that looks really beautiful on the images. How did you come up with that way of...
Yeah, so, you know, beauty was not the intent, but it is true, and it's interesting. Why would aesthetically this be appealing is a deep mystery to me. Because, you know, this is not a part of the body that is ever shown, and it's usually monochromatic or translucent, so you don't even know it's there. And then suddenly you put these jellyfish genes into these cells and allow them to change the colors of cells, and you see this really gorgeous-looking stuff. We were trying to come up with a way of watching wires as they change, and we were constantly defeated by the fact that many of the techniques would label just a very small number of wires, but so you couldn't see the context of the changes. Or if all the wires were labeled, they were all labeled with the same color, and therefore you couldn't tell which particular wire was doing what. There's a traditional stain, the Golgi stain, which is a really powerful stain that labels a very small number of nerve cells one color. And that was the birth of neuroscience, actually, that stain. What we basically were trying to do is make a technicolor Golgi, a technique where instead of only having one cell, a small number of cells sparsely labeled with one color, every cell would be labeled. So you'd have dense labeling, but you'd have so many colors, you could just particulate out each different cell type.
It's very clever.
It is. One other thing to say about Brainbow that's kind of interesting is this is an example of a kind of evolution of animals that are being evolved based on human thought, not based on natural selection, not based on any Darwinian principle. In fact, Brainbow is an example where jellyfish genes are being put into mice to make them glow these remarkable number of colors. And that's just something no other animal but humans can do. And we can do it only because of our brains, of course. So it's all a very internested set of questions about how these techniques come about to study the brain when it is the brain that allowed these techniques to come about in the first place.
Yeah. Well, that leads me to my next question, because are human brains different than other mammals' brains?
I think so. I think there's no doubt, looking at how successful we are as a species, that there's never been a mammal like us before. And one could, I think, make a strong argument that in the history of life on the planet, which is more than 2 billion years old, living things, there's never been an animal even close to us. We are that much an outlier. Every species is unique in one way or another, but we're unique in so many ways that there's just nothing like us. And we have also, you know, because we're traveling now, exploring outer space, and we're also beginning to manipulate genomes, not just Brainbow mice, but, you know, thinking about ways of curing disease, humans are becoming a kind of animal that is taking evolution into its own hands, if you will, at some point in the future, maybe for good or for ill, maybe more likely for bad than for good. But also we're figuring out how to leave the planet, which potentially makes us an immortal species in the sense that even if we destroy this planet, which I think at the moment, if you were betting, you'd say is possible at least, it's not incredibly unlikely, we would still survive. Again, is something no other animal on this planet, unless we take them with us, like Noah did on the Ark. there's no other way the other animal would survive.
So what is it in the nature of our brains that makes it different?
I think there are a number of things. One obvious thing is that we grow up very, very slowly. So when most animals have to fend for themselves at a young age, we're still completely dependent on our caregivers, typically our parents. But even early development, humans take about a year to walk. That's a very long time compared to other animals that walk. And then humans get a driver's license, but not a year later. It takes another 15 years, at least in the United States, before anyone will give you a driver's license. And then another 2 years after that before you leave the nest in many countries. And then you don't actually get a PhD until you're 30, 35, and you don't get tenure until you've got gray hair. Our development is very, very slow. And what that means is we are constantly being buffeted by experiences that are modifying us and giving us a kind of expertise that most other animals can't do because their wiring diagram, in my worldview, is kind of fixed at a very early age. So I think that's one big and perhaps the most important thing that separates us from other animals. We figured out a way to let our babies be helpless for much longer than any other animal. And I think that gives us a real edge.
But this seems like a very good survival strategy when you see we are very good at surviving everywhere, living everywhere and destroying everything else. So how come no other species has this sort of way of developing?
I think there probably was in the early history of humans. There were a bunch of other related animals that were very much like us that are all extinct now. And I think there's only one explanation for that. That's us. We killed them because we're a terrible species, as evidenced by everything in the world. So it's maybe a little sad, but I think you might ask, why aren't there super smart insects or super smart octopus? They have gigantic brains as well, but they grow up very early and they live a very short life. Humans have a slow development and a long life and have figured out how to protect the babies so they don't need to grow up early. And that's a subtle trick, because the world, when humans first came into the world, was not a very hospitable place for humans. You know, they were hunting animals to eat, but animals were hunting them to eat as well. It was a tough world. And it's kind of amazing that it finally took hold. But once human points of view took hold and tool making took over, then they became the dominant species very quickly. And they killed off their competitor species and most of their food as well.
You told about the mapping the mice brain and using those colors. Can we use data from mice brains in understanding the human brain when we're so different?
I think there are many things when you look very closely at a mouse brain that remind you very much of a human brain. But there's no doubt we are not mice. And there are people who study primates who say that there's a whole fundamental organization of primates that are different from mice. But I remind those people that we're also not orangutans. orangutans are closer to mice than they are to people, I think, in terms of their behavior. So I think there is really something quite special about humans, and we have to study human brains. And that's why we are studying human brain now. From patients who are undergoing neurosurgery, if we're fortunate enough to be there, this is anonymized tissue. The surgeon sometimes provides us with small samples from patients that are being treated for something else where surgery is necessary, and we take that and study that tissue with our connectomic methods.
So when Jeff Lichtmann and his lab is lucky to get a small piece of living human brain that has been removed from an anonymous patient due to another issue, they take it into the lab and cut from the block of brain by a diamond knife the thinnest tissues possible. The cut is made by a machine which is making a constant soundtrack to the workdays in the lab.
So there is a section coming sliced. And then if you look here, you slowly see these sections moving back on this tape that's carbon coated.
The thin slides of brain are being collected as a film strip, an image in an electron microscope, and the images are then made into a small film where you can go into the brain nanometer per nanometer and see all the different cells and the pathways and connections between the neurons.
And this site here is the synapse where this axon is talking to this dendrite. The dendrite is receptive, the axon is releasing neurotransmitter, and the dendritic spine is coming off of a big dendrite. So the flow of information in a Cahalian way is basically from axon to dendritic spine down the dendrite towards the cell body. So that's one section. But what we want to do is follow each of these processes through the volume. So we have to do this for every single section and then align all them.
You now have a digital box of brain, and a single object can be traced in that volume. To trace all the different objects that are totally packed together in this highly dense digital box of brain, they use good old color book style, where all the different objects are colored in different colors.
Using a coloring book style that even Harvard undergrads can do, just requires them to color, and then at the end they get a letter of recommendation to go to medical school. So they're very happy to do this. So here's a little box of brain, and they pick an object on the first set, color it in, and then on the next one they color it in again, and on the next one they color it in again, and so on. Yeah, a Harvard student can do that. And then, voila, you get the three-dimensional rendering of that dendrite with all its spines, and here's an axon that's making synapses on two of those spines.
The digital box of brain that now has been colored color book style by Harvard students shows how dense the brain is. It's not at all Kahalian style where you can easily follow each neuron from axon to dendroid. It is so dense with dendroids, axons, and glia cells, which are other brain cells, not neurons. But even though they just mapped a tiny bit of brain, which took them years, it shows a lot of elemental things about the brain. For example, it shows that the neurons talk to a lot of other neurons, that there is a lot of weak connections, where two neurons only have a few connections, and a lot fewer strong connections, where two neurons have enough connections for one neuron to send a large enough signal to the other one to cause a reaction in the other neuron. Mapping the brain, neuron by neuron, it's not just a life project, it's a many lives project.
What are your hopes and dreams for what we're going to find in your life?
Well, yeah, I'm getting on in years, so I have to be careful what I wish for here because some of these things may be unrealistic. I think the most current step that I'd like to see done before I kick the bucket is to get an entire mammalian brain's wiring diagram, a whole mouse connectome. I think getting a whole human connectome is a little out of reach because the digital content of that would be comparable to the amount of digital data generated in a year by the world. We're just not ready to do that as scientists. Even doing a mouse, we're dealing with a data set that would probably be in the range of an exabyte, a term you may not know, which is 1,000 petabytes. And even a petabyte you may not know. 1,000 petabytes is 1,000,000 terabytes is what an exabyte is. And a terabyte you may know is 1,000 gigabytes. So we're talking about trillions of megabytes of data. And that's just a lot of data. That's just for a mouse brain. But I think we're ready to do that now. So the government of the United States, the National Institutes of Health, I think thinks this is a good idea now. So they've just offered the first release of people to apply for the prequel to do a whole mouse brain. So I'm quite excited about that. We'll see what happens.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Fun talking to you.
Thank you for listening to the Science and Cocktails podcast, which is funded by the Lundbeck Foundation and produced by me, Sophie Hjort, for the Science and Cocktails organization. Music by Hjalte Bistedhjort. I highly recommend to go to Science and Cocktails YouTube channel to see the whole talk. It's very interesting. And if you like this podcast, please share it with all your friends.